Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And before I preview this week's interviews, I just want to encourage all of you to dip into your Risky Business podcast feed and have a listen to our latest edition of Snake Oilers. I worked really hard on it, and I think it's come up really well. It's a wholly sponsored show where I speak to vendors about their tech, but everyone I spoke to for that edition had really interesting stuff to say. So yeah, do check it out, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. But yes, on this week's show, we will be chatting with Scott Helm about HTTP public key pinning as an attack vector. If someone manages to hack your domain registrar, for example, they'll be able to redirect people to a box they control. And if they can get a free automated domain validated cert for that box and then flick on the HPKP header and pin every visitor to a certificate and key that they control, well, then when you get your domain back, you're in a bit of trouble because everybody who visited your site while it was under the attacker's control can no longer visit your web page, right? Because they're pinned to the attacker's key and cert. Yay. So Scott's going to join us this week to talk about HPKP as an attack vector and what we might do about this situation. That's an interesting chat coming up a little bit later on. This week's sponsor interview is fascinating. We'll be chatting with Homer Strong, who is the Director of Data Science at Cylance. I actually met Homer at the Risky Business Party in Las Vegas, and I should say too, big thanks to everyone who came to that party and also to the vendors who sponsored it. It was a great night. And yeah, Homer is joining us this week to have an in-depth discussion about machine learning explainability and interrogatability. Cylance, of course, has been using machine learning to do at-scale malware classification long before it was hip. And Homer is a really smart guy who'll be walking us through how to tackle some of the challenges of using magic algos to make decisions for us. And I will say this, it is the most interesting sponsor interview that we've run in a while. It's really good stuff. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Haroon Mir, who is filling in for Adam Boileau this week. And Haroon, in what looks to be a sort of vindication of sorts for Muddy Waters and MedSec, Abbott, the global health group that acquired St. Jude Medical, is calling on about 500,000 people to get their pacemakers and implantable medical devices patched. This is a world first.
It's interesting and simultaneously terrifying. Like, please come in so that we can patch your pacemaker is probably not something anyone ever wants to hear. I'm not sure how it works out for MedSec, though, because if you remember the whole thing that said they'd short the stock. So I actually haven't checked, but I do recall at the time that the stock didn't move enough to make that little experiment profitable.
I'm not sure about that, actually, Haroon, because the stock did dip, and it's going to really depend on to what extent they were shorting and how leveraged they are. So they may have made a fair bit of money out of that. We just don't know.
Yeah, so I've got no idea. I'd actually be super interested in finding out because everyone was looking at this to say, well, is this a new form of disclosure? Is this a new lever? And certainly with the vindication that this brings, if they also made money, it's interesting times.
Well, even if they didn't make money on this one, they'll make money on the next one because in essence, what they said at the time has been borne out. But this is essentially a product recall. I mean, it's not a recall. Yeah. They're not actually having to operate on these patients, but this is a very big deal, I think. And I think next time a researcher goes to Muddy Waters with some security research, they'll probably run it up the flagpole again.
Yeah, certainly next time MedSec calls on someone, they're going to pay attention.
Yeah, well, as far as I know, the lawsuit between St. Jude and MedSec is still in progress, right? And I'm really curious to see how this will impact that, right? This looks pretty good for MedSec, not so great for St. Jude and Abbott. Our next story here comes to us via Motherboard, written by Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai. It turns out it looks possible. This story posits that a Mexican governor used some hacking team spyware to actually spy on the president of Mexico. Do we know by reading this story how likely that is? Is this a confirmed story or is it just someone's opinion, man?
So the story doesn't confirm it, but something that it does point out is that Mexico were hacking team's largest customer, something I didn't pick up the last time. So it certainly seems that there's lots of people running around in Mexico with access to Galileo or hacking team software. So yeah, it's certainly interesting, and of course, Hacking Team are not the only guys playing in there. And again, it raises the whole question of where these sorts of tools end up, and whether they end up hurting dissidents or helping fight cartels, which I guess is
or whether or not they wind up being used by corrupt government officials at the behest of cartels. That's got to be a consideration, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's kind of becoming one of the ethical problems of our time, right? Like, for some of it, it's super clear. Like, Hacking Team's email dumps certainly wouldn't have won them any friends. But if you ignore the fact that they were clearly a problem child, there's no doubt that Mexico have problems with the cartels. And if you were going to sell equipment to law enforcement, you wouldn't rule them out. So it raised an interesting thing. For us in the business, I think the one thing it's going to do is bring back the Your Boy Surge memes,
yes,
which had kind of died out.
We can thank Gruck for those. we've got a story here, Haroon, from Fortune, which is really interesting. It looks at attacks against users of Coinbase. And what's really interesting about this is that these attacks are happening at scale and rely heavily on SIM swap fraud.
This one was super interesting to me. So in South Africa, SIM swaps have actually been happening for a really long time.
Yeah, I remember because I've spoken at conferences over there, and it was like issue number one, like 8 years ago.
Yeah, yay for innovation in the South African crime space. But it is interesting to see the stuff bubble up. And the story actually had lots and lots of interesting components. One of them is just the fact that people are starting to realize that when you have a digital currency that specializes in being instant and irreversible, they instant and irreversible. And it's one of the problems that people are having with these sorts of Bitcoin attacks. And I suspect it's something people will just have to get used to. Like, if you buy bearer bonds and then lose them, you've lost them. And if you buy Bitcoin and delete your key or have your key stolen, then you've lost your Bitcoin. So I think that bit's interesting. Coinbase is interesting. Like I said, there's so many parts of the story that are cool. When they describe Coinbase, they refer to them as one of the few guys who haven't been hacked yet. And I think that's a sad indictment of the Bitcoin wallet industry. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they play this, because like, for the listeners, the attacks are not going against Coinbase, but are going against Coinbase users. And so,
but at scale, right? So how do you actually say whether that's an attack against Coinbase or their users? You know, to what degree does Coinbase have a responsibility to make that sort of stuff not possible, right? And that's where this gets really interesting for me, because, you know, the reason that I prefer to use my credit card instead of Bitcoin is if I order something off the internet and it doesn't turn up, I ring my bank and they refund my money, right? So there's more of an onus of responsibility on financial institutions as opposed to, Bitcoin exchanges and wallet services, right? That's the crux of the issue here.
Yeah, for sure. And I suspect Coinbase are smart enough to see that they need to fix this problem, or they're going to lose the thing that differentiates them from every other player in the space, which is user trust. So they already make 2FA a thing, but I suspect with the SIM swaps, what they're going to have to figure out is maybe they need to something other than SMS, which is so trivially attackable.
You get a YubiKey, and you get a YubiKey, and you get a YubiKey. Everybody gets a YubiKey, right? Staying with cryptocurrency, and I also stumbled across this fantastic list someone's knocked together of all of the high-profile cryptocurrency hacks, and it's a pretty big list.
Yeah, it's interesting. The whole Bitcoin thing, I mean, everyone who talks ransomware talks about how Bitcoin is enabling ransomware, but it always reminds me of something. Like, when we used to do training many moons ago, we used to tell people that web apps made hacking like the movies. And because, like, in the past, if you break into something, you've got a CLI interface to Swift, you can't really transfer money until web apps came and made it easy for you. And now Bitcoin makes stealing money like it was in the movies, like break in, steal the money, the guy sees his account being drained. It's very cool for the...
You're right. I mean, Bitcoin, it's a very valuable thing they've done, which is to make movie hacking real. Unlike Swordfish or something like that, where they're stealing billions of dollars and then the next day someone just comes in, taps a few keys into a console and the transfer gets reversed.
Exactly. They've taken that next step towards making us more like TV.
Yeah, great. Great. That's just what we need. Now, of course, there's been a big controversy in recent weeks over this warrant served against DreamHost. This was involving the DisruptJ20.org website, which was coordinating protests against Trump. One of those protests, there was a small amount of people rioting. I'm really not clear on so much about this, right? Because it's clear as mud from the write-ups that I've seen. The initial warrant, I think what they were trying to do is get a copy of the entire site, and that would have included logs, right? So DreamHost went back and said, no, there's 1.3 million people who visited this site. Can you narrow your request? So they sort of disputed the warrant. DOJ has come back and asked them to exclude logs from... They've now said, okay, well, we're not going to take the Apache logs or whatever web server they're running. And we're also not going to take unpublished media, like composed but not posted blog posts and things like that.
Yeah,
so what it looks like to me is they're actually trying to get the server content, not so much the server logs, right? Because they want to be able to dip into emails between people who were sort of running the site. Is that your reading as well? Because I think...
Yeah, it seems like... I think everybody, and understandably, like everybody is a little jumpy around this sort of stuff. So when the story first broke, it had the undertones of a draconian overreach that said, tell me everyone who visited the site so that we can hunt them down. And from the way it's gone now, it seems pretty much like it was just a badly written warrant, and they've fallen back to, hey, we just want the data on the site. We're not trying to get a hold of everyone who ever visited it.
But it looks like they're after the mail spool, right? Which is still a bit of a privacy concern. That means anyone who's emailed, disruptj20.org is now potentially going to have those emails looked at. But in a big win for DreamHost, apparently the courts have put some pretty tight restrictions about how DOJ can use this data. Like it's all going to be done under court supervision. So it looks like... I mean, it's not perfect, but it looks like maybe it's going to be an acceptable outcome.
Yeah, and DreamHost say they're still going for they're still disputing some of the stuff. So maybe they'll keep winning, but so far seems like a rare piece of good news.
Yeah, so it's not they're not unmasking 1.3 million visitors to DisruptJ20.org anymore. So that's good. Nicely done. Joseph Cox over at the Daily Beast has a great story about SS7 tracking. Basically, there's all these. It's like becoming a cottage industry. You know, give us a phone number and we will physically track this phone for you. It's amazing that this has just become a thing that's so available, right? SS7 tracking for the win.
Yeah, it's interesting because this and some of the earlier stories are kind of a stark contrast. Like if you look at it, it's taking Black Hat talks from 5 years ago and then monetizing it for the unscrupulous of the world. And in this case, like SS7 attacks, you've covered them many times in the past. Like we know the risks. On a global network, it seems like there's a whole bunch of people who just give you tracking down to the nearest antenna for a small fee. So, it's interesting to see it get monetized like this.
Oh, and we've got some great detail, courtesy of Joseph, about how the European cops were decloaking Hansa users after they'd taken them over, the Dutch. And apparently they were doing it with an XL file, which is just such a cool idea. You know, Hansa users were sent these XL files, which were purporting to be summaries of their transactions. It's like, hey, we've generated a balance sheet for you. Do you know what I mean? And you can open it up. And you were actually quoted in this piece, Haroon, because they used like a canary token style beacon to decloak people. This is very cool.
Yeah, so we actually took a quick look at at least the format of the canary token to see if it was an exact match with ours. And it's off by like a directory. So the idea again is I think it's super cool and it's exactly what you want from your tokens, right? It finds a side channel home. In this case, it's a simple URL get, So no, I think it's exactly what you want with those sorts of things, and it's exactly why we make Canary tokens available to the whole world for free.
Yeah. So next time your drug empire gets sent an Excel spreadsheet from your drug market saying, "Hey, yeah, this will make your bookkeeping easier," maybe don't open that. I love this story. I absolutely love this story. It's on Bleeping Computer. There's the Intel ME component, the management engine, which is just a horrible thing that gets people owned. Some researchers sort of pulled it apart to try to figure out if they could disable it. And they found there was a place where they could flip a bit and it would actually just completely disable it, which is fantastic. But it turned out that it was the bit was labeled reserve_HAP. And a nearby comment calls it the high assurance platform. So you can sort of enable high assurance platform. Now, that's an NSA program that basically the US government and the NSA insisted that this capability be in it so that they could use it in high security environments, which I just think is unreal that, apparently NSA were onto this one like ages ago. Why not tell us though, guys? Come on, what are you doing? Like, share that with us.
So that's this story again has a bunch of hidden interesting things that I didn't expect. So the one is this NSA HAP thing, which again is nothing sinister for the tinfoil hats. They are a big government agency and they're gonna have a high security environment and they get to flip a bit. But what's interesting is if you remember earlier this year there was a ridiculous vulnerability found in Intel AMT, which runs on top of the ME, right? Which was basically they were running this web server, and if you just sent it blank, it gave you access. Now, what's interesting is in response to that vulnerability, Intel released a firmware upgrade, and Intel released a tool that let you determine if you are vulnerable. But Intel never said, "Here, flip the switch and turn it off."
Yes,
and so. You'll see Intel make a small comment to say, like, well, HAP wasn't that well tested, but I can't believe that putting out a new firmware was quicker than testing HAP.
Yeah.
So there's still some dodginess in there as to, and I suspect it's Intel not wanting to turn ME off.
That's right. They don't want to turn it off because they see it as a value add, not a bloody nonstop carnival of clown show bugs, which is what it is, man. Yeah. Like, it's just... I'm sort of disappointed that Intel didn't come out and say, hey, you can disable it this way. And I'm also a little bit disappointed that the NSA didn't issue some guidance. But, then that's going to sort of ruin their relationship with Intel. So you can kind of get that. But it's an interesting story. It's one of the most interesting stories this week. And it's kind of been completely buried. It's like one outlet reporting on it.
Yeah, totally. And you know what else is just hidden and secretly interesting is if you look at the name on the blog post. So the guy who actually, one of the researchers who worked on this, is Dmitry Skylarov.
I remember him. He was the PDF DMCA guy who got arrested at DEF CON. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. So props to him for still doing awesome stuff like 17 years later, for putting himself in the way of arrest.
For listeners who weren't around back then, this guy did a DEF CON talk. I think it was DEF CON, not Black Hat, about removing DRM protections on PDFs. And he actually got arrested at DEF CON and charged with a bunch of stuff. Eventually it went away, but it was a big deal at the time. So way to go, Dmitry, if you are listening. I met his boss once at some conference somewhere when he was still working for the company that did password cracking. They did Elcomsoft, that's the one. Yeah, anyway, thanks for the trip down memory lane. Now, this next story, Haroon, it really has me conflicted. I'm experiencing some major cognitive dissonance here because in China, they're introducing a real name policy for online comments. And on one hand, I think, a real name policy is a great idea because it really cuts down posting. But on the other hand, there is the freedom of expression aspect and the freedom to be anonymous on the internet. But still, wouldn't it be nice if there was a real name policy on everything?
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I don't know what your Facebook timeline looks like, but my Facebook timeline is filled with people with real names, and I still see enough annoying posts. So I'm not sure that real names actually do that much to stop people from being jerks on the internet. And I think when it comes to something like this from China, you're going to think it's not because they're interested in
people having polite discourse.
No, they're not. They're not introducing it in order to be a more civil society. That's for sure. But I will say that my Facebook feed is a lot friendlier than the average YouTube comment thread. So there's that.
Yeah, that's because the only thing worse than the average YouTube comment is the average speech by the current most powerful person in the world.
Yeah. I've often said that Donald Trump, and I read this somewhere else, I can't remember where, but he's it's like a YouTube comment thread gained sentience and has run for president. there you go. We've seen another fantastic BGP fat finger and Google again, because last time something this major happened, it was Pakistani ISP that fat fingered a BGP announce that wound up dropping like half of YouTube, which is kind of funny. But Google managed to, knock half of Japan off the internet with an accidental BGP route hijack. This is kind of funny.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So when it came, everybody's first thought goes to YouTube Pakistan. And this time it's actually Google. And Google hit a few ISPs, but like a single ISP in Japan covers like 7 million people. And when they took them out, they took out all of Japan, who then went into a panic. I mean, it's bad enough they've got rockets flying over them. Now you're taking them off the internet too. I think it just points to BGP being a pain.
Bleeping Computer also reports that someone has released a fully working exploit for the iOS kernel, Apple's iOS kernel. Zimperium released this, but this is a patched bug, but it's still going to be interesting reading for people who do research, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting for people who do research, but I also think there's something else that's interesting in there. Like, if you read the guy's thinking when he did the research, he kind of has the section that says, I went fishing for unhardened components, and then he comes up with Apple AVE in IOKit. And he makes a comment at some point that says, like, I found Apple AVE, and it was written without any basic security fundamentals. And it's interesting, like, for all the credit that we give Apple for hardening iOS as a platform, you got to remember that they've made trade-offs and they're operating under schedules. And yeah, not all of it is as rock solid as people would think. So there's room for dumping in there yet.
Yeah, Zerodium, meanwhile, has, these guys are the zero-day brokers or whatever. They've announced their new pricing structure. I mean, this is mostly a marketing exercise, but they're offering up to like $500,000 for bugs, for really cool bugs, right? And they're really keen on bugs in things like WhatsApp, Signal, Facebook Messenger, iMessage, Telegram, and all of that. I think the $500,000 figure is for zero interaction bugs. Is that right?
Yeah, I must confess that this stuff is hard for me to correctly pass. In part because Zerodium Chauki Becker, if I'm pronouncing it right, is kind of unafraid of putting himself out there and kind of trolling people. So you never quite know whether it's you can really glean anything meaningful from it, or whether it's him just half trolling people and using it for marketing. But it is interesting times if a bug in WhatsApp or a bug in Signal now gets you $500,000.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny, IoT story of the week is Samsung issued an update to smart TVs in the UK that bricked them. Happy days. That's always hilarious. Krebs on Security and a bunch of other outlets actually have a report about the takedown of an Android DDoS botnet called WireX. This is actually a pretty interesting read.
Yeah, it's interesting for me for multiple reasons, but like ultimately, you've got all of these hacked Androids out there, and they were being used as part of a DDoS network, or at least a DOS network, and of course the source of it is just these horrible apps sitting on the Android Play Store. So some 300 different mobile apps were all contributing to this network. And what's interesting is they weren't just stupidly doing a ping minus F. Like these, the software on them, it seems, was originally written for click fraud. So they're actually reasonably good at sending out browser, sending themselves out as good browser traffic, which makes it a lot harder to identify the traffic and then mitigate it. So a bunch of different people, Akamai, Google, all got involved and shut this down.
Wired, meanwhile, is carrying a really interesting feature. I don't think we're going to have time to go through it all right now, but basically it's about a meth head going on a robbery spree through hotels by hacking door locks. And it's, you know, it's Andy Greenberg wrote it up, and he's been writing really good long form features lately. And, you know, I'd sort of wondered why the Threat Level blog had been quiet for a while. And I'm guessing it's because he was writing this one. So there's a link in this week's show notes to that. That is a great read. Google, meanwhile, has reminded admins that as of October, HTTP pages will be marked as not secure by Chrome browser. So that's one to keep in mind. Oh, this is a hilarious story. Marcus Hutchins, Malware Tech blog. This is the guy who got arrested in Las Vegas, you know, the so-called accidental hero of the WannaCry outbreak. Some lawyers set up a fundraising page for him, and they received like $150,000 in donations, but like 90% of it, like more than 90% of it, turned out to be fraudulent. So coming from fraudulent cards, so they've had to refund the whole lot because it just got too hard. But that's kind of funny, right?
Yeah, that's just a horrible look. In the end, they say it was probably one or two people who spoiled it for everyone running a few bad cards. But yeah, that just doesn't give you the look of absolute propriety that you want going into a case like this when you were clearly sponsored by a whole bunch of crims.
It's pretty much five-star trolling doing that, but there you go. We've got an interesting story here from ThreatPost about third-party installers for Mac OS or OS X. And they're doing some things that are hideously insecure, which can enable people to do all sorts of horrible things to like software updates. Patrick Wardell, who's the chief security researcher at SYNAC, did this research, and it looks like this is a legit problem for Apple here. And it's mostly because it's sort of out of their control, right?
Yeah, so not quite. So it's actually, as I understand it, it's actually an Apple API that's being abused. The problem is just that most of the third parties are using this now deprecated API, which does things insecurely. And it's an interesting lesson for everyone in terms of making the right thing easier to do. So this API, authorize, execute with privileges, essentially doesn't check whether the file it's executing has been modified or not. And there's now a safer way to do it, except like the researcher says, when he tried to do it the right way, it took him several hours to get right. So almost everyone, and there's a list of apps like Google Chrome, Slack, Dropcam, VMware Fusion, all use this insecure deprecated API. So it's an interesting lesson that like if you want people to do things right, you better make it easy enough for them to do the right thing.
There's been this talk of an exploit about being able to change email post-delivery. That mostly involves fiddling like remotely hosted cascading style sheets. This isn't really a story, and I'm sort of surprised that so many news services have run with this, aren't you? Like this so-called rope maker thing. Yeah, it seems like a big nothing burger to me.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be all that. In one of the comments on the stories, the original author said, hey, there's more to this, more information coming. But of course, nothing's come since then, so I'm guessing he figured out it wasn't much either. One of the things about it is email CSS is not as fully featured as web page CSS. So there's not that much that can be done with it, but certainly you can think of a few social engineering type tricks that can be done. Like the thought is interesting, I'm just not sure it's a three-bell alarm.
Yeah, well, a lot of mail gateways actually block remotely hosted CSS anyway, right? So I just don't think, you know, it's abusing functionality that's, you know, it's all behaving as intended. It's just web tech, right? Like, so I don't really get the big deal with that one.
Yeah, which is what everyone came back with, right? So no CVE was assigned. Microsoft came back and said, we'll not fix. So I think that seems to be what the vendors are saying, and now the researchers are kind of getting mileage for it.
Now, this last story that we've got is just, I mean, this is just one of those things where you look at some business software and you realize that it's just not fit for purpose. This story deals with the SAP, the SAP point of sale solution. And some people have found out that if you have like unauthenticated network access to the same network that this POS gear is on, you can actually start changing prices, which means, you know, you go into a store, you say, gee, that looks like a nice laptop. You can change, you know, change the price, give yourself $500 off, you know, know, load that into the POS system, grab the laptop, buy it, and get your discount. So this is bad. You know, like a POS system should not be able to be abused in this way.
Yeah, certainly POS systems shouldn't be allowed to give you 100% discount just by changing an XML file without any authentication. So clearly sounds like it's bad. What's interesting deep in the article is that they say several other POS systems have the same architecture and are probably vulnerable to the same sort of flaw, which, yeah, just takes you back to everything is rotten, let's burn it down.
And last time I checked, SAP isn't a ma and pa operation, you know what I mean? Like, we should demand better from large companies like this. But Haroon, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for filling in for Adam, and I believe we'll be speaking in a sponsor slot in a couple of weeks. But I know you actually had a chance to listen to Snake Oilers this week. This is the podcast from Risky Biz where vendors get to explain their tech. What did you think of it?
I was pleasantly surprised. So I did listen to it and actually made a note to tell you I enjoyed it. You had three guests on, and all three, I actually wanted to hear more about what the product did. So I know a fair bit about CrowdStrike, but the other two, I completely hadn't heard of the inner workings. And like the first guys you had on, is it Replicated?
Yeah, Replicated.
The Replicated guys, it's not a security product, I gather, or they don't have lots of security guys on, but that's truly interesting. And it's an interesting twist. If you're deploying stuff from playbooks, then moving stuff from the cloud to on-prem is an interesting service. So no, in general, I thought it was good. I didn't switch off and wanted to keep listening. So, well played.
I bet there's listeners out there who haven't listened to it yet because it's, you know, because it's a wholly sponsored thing. But I wanted to get the Haroon Mir nod of endorsement. But mate, that's it for the week. For the week's news. Thank you so much for filling in, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Sounds good. Bye.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinks Canary there with a check of the week's security news. And I just want to say, for the handful of people out there who won't realize it, for the record, I think a real name comment policy like the one floated in China is a truly awful idea. So don't at me, bros or sisters, all right? I was just yapping. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Scott Helm, a British security consultant and founder of both securityheaders.io and report-uri.io. Last week, Scott wrote a blog post about HTTP public key pinning, an SSL feature he's worked with and built tools for. Now, there's a bit of history to go over here. Some years ago, a hacker thought to be linked with the Iranian government, who wound up being called Komodo Hacker, was running around owning certificate authorities and minting valid certs for sites like Facebook.com, Gmail.com, that sort of thing. These certs were being used in Iran to man-in-the-middle connections to those types of very public, high-profile services. In the end, there was a response. I think it was Google Chrome that moved first. It could have been Firefox. I can't remember. But they decided to pin the HTTPS certificates for major websites. They basically hard-coded them into the browsers so this sort of thing wouldn't work as a man-in-the-middle anymore. Okay, so far, so good. The thing is, certificate pinning is now available and has been available for a while to anyone running a website. You generate a private key, you know, you do your CSR, grab your certificate, load it up, and then you set the HPKP header so anyone who visits your site will be pinned to that certificate in the future. Great, right? Well, maybe not so much. Scott's post last week was called Why I'm Giving Up on HPKP, and he outlined some of the downsides, like what he calls HPKP suicide. That's when you lose your private key through just misadventure or a mistake. You set up a new one, and oh no, people who pinned your old cert to your site can now no longer view it. But there's an even scarier scenario called HPKP ransom. That's where someone jacks your domain, grabs a certificate from a CA like Let's Encrypt, and then pins it with HPKP. You get control back. You get control of your domain back. But anyone who's hit your site with browsers that support key pinning, like Firefox or Chrome, can no longer view content served by your server because the pin doesn't match the legitimate certificate. The attacker can then ransom the private key and the corresponding certificate back to the victim. Frankly, I'm a little bit surprised this hasn't already happened. You know, I mean, hacking a registrar would be one way to go about this, but, you know, even if you did a decent enough job with BGP hijacking, you could probably pull this off as well. Scott Helm joined me to discuss. Here's what he had to say.
it's kind of one of those vectors, like you say. I'm also surprised that we haven't seen this. We have seen a lot of people essentially do this to themselves accidentally. We call that one HPKP suicide. But ransom PKP is a real possibility, and I don't know why it's not happened yet. I don't know if it's just that the bad guys haven't realized that they can do this as easily as you could. Because, you know, if you take over a website and you put funny cat pictures on the homepage and that hits like mainstream news, everybody's going to go to that website to look. And the page doesn't have to do anything malicious. It's just to attract the visitors to lock them to the pins, like you say. So it doesn't even have to be, you know, for a long period of time. You just need to get someone to hit that homepage whilst you as the bad guy control it. And then that's it. You own them.
Well, and the really shitty thing is too, even if you buy this key back off the people who've owned you, that means that you have to use that key. So then you're using a private key and certificate that the attackers yep. actually have, right? So then they can, you know, man in the middle your stuff for eternity. So it's just all round bad news, right?
There is. I mean, there's so little way back from this, because you're exactly right. You're buying back a compromised private key. And I guess like what's wrong with that? It's the only like sane thing that you could try and do is just have like a 7-day period where you use the compromised key, but you didn't have like any login or anything, and the sole purpose of your site was just to break the pins. So you could say to everyone, right, come back to our site now. We're going to load like a blank page just to break the pins, and then in 7 days we'll throw that key away and go back to, you know, a new key, new cert, and bring the site back.
Yeah, well, if you've got a $100 million like marketing and public information budget to actually make that happen, that might be a strategy, right?
That would be great.
Well, the shitty thing is there is no way around this, right? And like, if we had our revocation shit together, like, it wouldn't be such a big deal. But like, how are you going to fix this with something like CRL, right? That's also a bad time.
Yeah, we have like these few issues that kind of, they all bind together. And right now we're making like the first steps in fixing all of them, but the ecosystem moves so slowly. We have such a lack of agility in the internet PKI. It's going to take time. And right now we're kind of in this zone where like we've identified the problems, but we're just waiting for time to pass by to fix them.
So I'm wondering, like, say I was using pinning, someone jacked my domain, it comes back. Do you think Google would be at all receptive? I mean, they'd even have to patch that out, wouldn't they, just for my website?
So yeah, they have. I know that there's a couple of instances where people have committed HPKP suicide, and they have had to wait for patches in Chromium to come along. So there have been two instances that I know of where Chrome has helped sites recover from suicide. But that's not going to scale for starters. that's really not going to help the masses, especially if we start seeing ransom attacks. The problem is there's no easy way to fix this, right? Like if you get ransomed, the easiest thing that you could probably do as a site operator to fix this is tell your users to uninstall and reinstall their browser. That's the simplest thing that I can think of that you could do to recover.
And how do you tell them when they can't view your website?
I know, right? So you're going to have to do like mail shots and social, and it's just going to be, I think if this does happen and I think it's going to be such a mess. I'm really hoping that it doesn't, because it's going to be dreadful.
See, pinning was a really good idea when Google was doing it through Chrome for things like Gmail and Facebook. Even then, there was some rough edges, right, when it came to like expiring certificates and things like that. But because there was a number of, you know, because it was a small number of sites, it seemed to be, you know, a workable solution. Why on earth was this made available to every Tom, Dick and Harriet to use, do you think?
Like, speaking to a couple of the guys at Google and, you know, reading most of the information that's publicly out there, there's two different types of pinning. There's static pinning and dynamic pinning. Dynamic pinning is HPKP. That's the one that we know and we're talking about, where anybody can do it and any site can turn it on and off. What they used to do historically was the static pinning, where the pins are just embedded into the browser. So they're literally written into the browser source code. And
well, and this was all in response to Komodo Hacker, right? This Iranian linked person who was going around like owning CAs and, you know, minting certificates for things like Facebook.com, you know?
I think because this started years ago. I think the first, what was the first one? It was the Dutch one. DigiNotar.
That was Komodo Hacker. That was the same crew, wasn't it?
Oh, was that the guy?
Yeah, I think it was.
But yeah, it was like DigiNotar was a CA, and they realized that, you know, obviously bad things can happen. CAs aren't perfect. They get popped. And I think what I think the real kind of stance was that they didn't want some kind of proprietary mechanism and custom code in Chrome, and it would be better to make an internet standard and, you know, have that available to everybody. So rather than just like one browser vendor taking the lead and building their own thing, I can kind of see what they mean in that it would be nicer and better to have a defined internet standard that everybody can get on board with rather than just one person going off and doing their own thing.
Yeah, the problem being that revocation is broken, really. Like, if you want to break it down, that's if we had decent revocation processes, this would be great, right?
Yeah, so I've been talking a lot about this recently. I actually did a talk at a conference, a B-Sides conference, just a couple of weeks ago about the current state of revocation. And it's, I mean, like, the title of the talk was Revocation is Broken, and Here's How We're Fixing It. And I mean, it's not that revocation is actually broken, because the mechanisms themselves work perfectly fine. It's just that there's no kind of good way to use them right now. You know, we need to fix this. And again, it's one of those things where we have new technologies coming that are on the horizon right now, but it just takes time to iterate these things through the ecosystem and to introduce new security measures like this.
Now, I seem to remember some talk about this idea of, I suppose you call it like a pseudo-pinning, right? Where you can compare the certificate that a site serves to you to other people's certificates from that site and you know, just sort of work out amongst the crowd whether or not, work out amongst your peers whether or not you're seeing the same certificate. As far as I know, that's still an academic idea that hasn't been put into production, but tell me if I'm wrong.
No, yeah. So this was kind of one of the ideas of what we could do with the PKI. So the Public Key Infrastructure Certificate Authorities, we can either fix the system and make the current system better, or we could replace it with something else. And this idea of having notary servers was one of the ideas of how we could replace it. So as you say, like you would connect to a website like PayPal, you would get their certificate and inspect that, and you would connect to a series of these kind of notary servers around the world, and they would all connect to PayPal, and they would tell you what they see. Now, if you all see the same thing, you could have some level of confidence that you weren't under attack and you weren't being singled out.
I mean, now, I just feel like trying to replace CAs all at once might be a little bit ambitious, you know? Like, couldn't you use notaries and still have CA-signed certs as well? I mean, wouldn't it make sense to sort of start at the halfway mark?
Yeah, see, we do kind of come across this problem a lot of the time when we look at replacing CAs. It's, you know, kind of like rip them out and throw them in the bin and start with something fresh. I don't think that's ever going to happen. And the only problem then as well is if we were to introduce a second kind of mechanism like a notary server, then the first problem is the performance impact on the client. This is kind of always the big thing. It's incredibly difficult to try and look at fixing this problem without having a massive negative impact on the client. So you hit PayPal. Typically nowadays, you could probably load the PayPal site in 500 millis if you're on a good connection. If you then have to connect to like three globally distributed notaries and wait for them to connect and tell you what they see, you know, you could be like quadrupling the page load time. There's always a significant performance impact on the client whenever I look at other things. And I don't think anybody's ever going to want to do that. Because if one browser vendor went first and did that, you know, let's say Firefox did that, and then all of a sudden all of their page load times are four times longer than Chrome, they're going to shed market share faster than you can blink.
So how do you think this is going to shake out, right? Can you foresee Google and Mozilla actually withdrawing support for HKPK from their browsers?
I don't know. We're literally at the point now where we need to make a decision on what to do with this. Either I think there could be an update to the spec. So one of the things that's commonly talked about is an opt-out mechanism. So you could set the HPKP header and just have like a never pin directive. So you can issue that header and say to the browser, I will never turn this feature on, so just lock me out. That sounds great and it would probably fix the problem, but realistically speaking, like how many websites are going to turn that on and do that? And should we have to turn on this thing to opt out of this thing? It's not really a clean solution. Another suggestion from Ivan Ristich was to somehow link the validity period of the header to the expiration of the certificate. So you could never pin longer than the current cert was valid. And also if that certificate was to be revoked, then it would break the pin set by it. But again, it would work, you know, that would fix the problem. It's a technical solution, but I wonder if it's viable, you know, pragmatically speaking, is that ever gonna it's like, it's great that it works on paper, but when I cast my mind into the real world and think, you know, what can we do with this, it's a tough one. It's an opt-in security mechanism, and you know, there's no way to kind of opt out.
Yeah. So, Scott, I want to walk you through what I think is the ultimate pinning ransom attack, which is I take over a domain registrar and I redirect all of their domains. I get myself Let's Encrypt certs for all of those domains and set the header active, and I do it in bulk, and there you go. I've just hosed, say, 50,000 websites, maybe 500,000 websites, and maybe 10 of them are somewhat important, and I've just caused bad days everywhere. Do you think, I mean, is that the way you'd go about it as an attacker? I'm curious, because that's probably what I'd do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's two different ways that you would go at it. One is like en masse and just hose everything, like you say. And we actually saw a time recently, the .io registrar, they forgot to renew the domains for one of the main name servers for .io, and some researcher managed to register it. And if he wanted to, he could have done pretty much exactly what you just said. So like this, we've already had a point in time when that theoretically could have happened had it been someone with less honest intentions. And then the other way is a very targeted attack. So I somehow hijack your particular domain. And not only HPKP, you could probably mess around with HSTS as well there at the same time, just to add insult to injury.
Just what, like strict?
Yeah, so just set HSTS, set it to strict. And depending on how long you're in control, you could probably try and sneak in a preload as well. That probably wouldn't succeed, but it's extra hassle that you could create as the attacker, right? You've got the name servers, you can get a valid cert, and you just set HSTS, lock them onto that, set HPKP to lock them onto your pins, and why not just submit a preload for the fun of it? You know, you could go to town with something like a registry level hijack like that.
The thing is though, browser makers just hate removing functionality. So if I had to guess, you're probably right, and this is going to wind up with some sort of extra header thing that you set, which says do not pin. You know, you've got like an anti-pinning header and a pinning header. Do you know what I mean? And there's like, it's like an East Coast versus West Coast sort of battle.
And how awesome does that sound?
Oh God. And it won't work, right? Because people won't set it unless, yeah, they just won't set it. So the only solution here really is for them to remove this, right?
If we're looking for like total protection against the misuse of it, then right now it's either major update to the spec or to remove it. The closest that I've come, I work with a couple of financial institutions here in the UK and a couple of large corporates. And you know, if you've got an app pool of like 1,000 servers and they have their F5s and their load balancers at the edge, they actually have these devices configured to strip the headers on the way out. Because if someone pops one of your app servers, they can add a header. Or maybe it could be like an overzealous developer who's read this cool new feature and wants to turn it on. You know,
so you know people who are already stripping this, right? Because they're worried about this. This is an addressed risk. This is amazing that people are actually thinking about it, you know?
No, this is I do consultancy work with large financials and a couple of large corporates, and they literally strip these headers now. And one of them, if they detect the header, it raises a SEV1, what they call a SEV1 severity 1 incident on their help desk to say, we've just detected an outbound page with a HPKP header in it. You know, this is like...
all that does is mitigate the suicide risk. It does nothing about someone outside your organization doing it to you.
Yeah, this is literally just if one of your app servers goes rogue, gets popped, or one of your devs, you know, thinks it's a good idea, like any external kind of DNS or domain hijack, this won't help. But they do have external monitoring as well, where they have uptime monitors externally as well anyway. So they, you know, they pull back to the site from various vantage points around the world. And again, they will also monitor the headers as one of the aspects of that. It's not just uptime and, you know, downtime detectors. It's, can we see HPKP set externally? And again, they will raise an incident for that. So there are already organizations out there that are aware of this threat and are actively trying to mitigate it.
Well, Scott Helm, thank you very much for coming onto the show. And thank you very much for writing such an excellent blog post about this, because it was a proper wildfire spread last week when you published it. And I think a lot of people just read it, particularly the part about, you know, the possibilities for ransom attacks, and they just sort of blanched a little bit. It was very interesting stuff. And yeah, again, thanks for coming on the show to talk about it.
No worries. Thank you very much.
That was Scott Helm there talking about HPKP and the problems that come with it. Oh my God. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now. Cylance, spelled C-Y-L-A-N-C-E, is an antivirus company that famously trumpets its machine learning technology. But it must be said, they were into machine learning before it was cool and everybody was doing it. They're like machine learning hipsters, if you will. A so-called tech unicorn that's hit a valuation of $1 billion, Cylance, like a couple of other companies in the so-called next-generation endpoint security space, are eating the incumbent AV companies alive. The feedback I get about Cylance from people who use it is there's a twofold clincher. It's really easy to manage, and its detection rates are higher than legacy products. That means less time reimaging boxes, which means, savings from your budget. Yay! And I got to say, too, that Cylance is pretty open about the idea that it won't stop everything. They're not claiming they're perfect. They're claiming that they're measurably better and that they're easier to manage. Now, back to the machine learning stuff. It's basically impossible to do malware classification manually these days. There are just too many variants and old tooling just wasn't keeping up. Now, machine learning is an extremely helpful tool for human analysts doing malware classification, but it's also useful at blocking previously unseen malware automatically. And that's, obviously a big sales hook for the companies that offer machine learning based tools like these. Now, a couple of months back, we had InQtel's Chief Security Officer, Dan Gear, on the show. And our next guest, Cylance's Director of Data Science, he heard that interview. Now, Gear spoke a lot about this idea that machine learning is great, but understanding how machine learning-driven technology arrives at its decisions can be borderline impossible. Homer was keen to talk about that in more detail, obviously, because his job is doing applied machine learning in real-world scenarios. Chiefly, what he wanted to discuss was the concept of machine learning model explainability. Here he is explaining what ML explainability actually is.
So I think that it's probably very similar to interrogatability, but it's basically the concept that a human can understand why a machine learning prediction ended up as it ended up. So like, why is this file bad? Or why is this network traffic anomalous? Or why does this picture appear to have some nudity in it or something like that? So in all these cases, there's some machine learning AI classifier which is making a decision, and it's looking at the data to do that. But a human wants to know, like, always why, a classic human question. And from an engineering point of view, we can sort of do like QA tests and regression tests. But, of course, it's incredibly important, especially for autonomous systems like a self-driving car. The self-driving car fails, it runs a red light. It's not really a satisfying explanation to say that we don't know why it ran the red light. We're just going to train a deeper neural network and hope that the next one doesn't suffer from the same issue.
And of course, we need explainability because some of the ways that you can fool machine learning systems are quite subtle.
Especially with autonomous systems like self-driving cars, there are these cases where you can kind of like perturb or fuzz the inputs a little bit. And my favorite one, I don't know if you've seen this yet, Pat, is this called robust physical world attacks, where basically you can put sort of like graffiti or like stickers on signs, and very reliably machine learning models in self-driving cars will misinterpret the signs. So like it'll just like miss stop signs because there's like a little sticker on the stop sign. Or there's like a right turn sign can be misclassified as like a stop sign in like very like a wide range of conditions. So things like this are kind of terrifying because from the point of view of like Cylance, where we're making these models, we really need to take sort of like the adversarial point of view and try to anticipate the different kinds of attacks that could be perpetrated on our models once we release them into the wild.
And some of those attacks are quite subtle, is the point with the street signs, right?
Yeah, exactly. Both quite subtle and also kind of like deep neural networks tend to be quite vulnerable to these. So I think a major area of research is how we can make models that are much more robust and insensitive to these kinds of sort of like trivial changes, like that to a human look completely useless, but or sort of like we're not distracted by them, like we can sort of like see completely right through them. But for a machine learning model, it just completely throws them off. And I loved your kangaroo example of the kangaroo looking like it's a human like walking away. But like that's sort of just like a funny one. But like, you know, you can like, you'd probably kill people if you really wanted to.
So how does one go about engineering this sort of, you know, decision-making transparency into a machine learning based tool? Because I imagine it's quite hard when you're dealing with such complicated data sets and such nuance in how these models make their decisions, that unless you've sort of built it with this as an expectation, I mean, I imagine it'd be a hard thing to bolt on later is what I'm getting at.
Absolutely. And you're completely right. So especially with like deep learning is sort of all the rage these days in machine learning and AI. And especially with deep learning, it's really unclear how to extract any kind of interpretability from the model that you might be able to understand. So there are black box sort of interpreters, and you can kind of like bolt them onto the side of an arbitrary black box machine learning algorithm, and they'll try to tell you why the black box is doing what it is, and I'm sort of trying to reproduce what the black box is going through in more understandable terms. So, and in machine learning, kind of more generally, there's been several kind of like research papers that kind of try to implement this. So one is LIME, which is from by Samir Singh, which comes from a paper called "Why Should I Trust You?" Explaining the predictions of any classifier. So that's like a popular one. But the answer is that it's really not a tractable problem. And even when it is, what you typically get out are like, here are the characteristics of like the file that you're analyzing or the image of a stoplight. Here are like the parts of it which influence the decision of the model. But even that can be kind of like misleading to a human and aren't really satisfying for the human asking why.
Now, I'd imagine that, you know, a lot of the reason that you've had to think about this is because you would have had to examine some problems that have been caused by misclassification in, you know, in Silence's tool. So, like, I'm really interested to hear about one of those examples where maybe some legit software got tagged as malicious and you've had to look at it and figure out why. Can you walk us through an example?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll maybe like discuss sort of like a hypothetical example. But I think that it's useful for exactly what you say. Like when we have a miss, when we have mistakes, then it helps guide fix to those mistakes. So like if we have, say, you know, like some game, like from a game developer that we false on, maybe it's suspicious because it's there's, for example, maybe anti-cheating implementations or mechanisms that it comes with. And
so it's
and
like loaded full of like network enabled code and obfuscations galore, right? So I imagine would be like whoop whoop.
Well, exactly. And they do stuff like, you know, they monitor like the keyboard events because they want to make sure that you're not like automating actions in the game necessarily. So there's sort of like potentially key logging kind of indicators in there. So with cases like that, we kind of use the features to help sort of determine what is characteristic. How are these? Why is the model accusing these of being malicious? And really, like the problem, it is useful because we find the characteristics of the file, and so these are the infamous features of machine learning that I'm referencing. I'm calling them characteristics sometimes, but really the we can apply kind of like a patch, and we can correct the model, but only based on the characteristics. So we're kind of like speaking in the language of the model. We're not really necessarily understanding from a human point of view what's going on. We're just saying we can see where the model is going wrong in its own terms based on the characteristics that it's examining, but why it's looking at those characteristics, or even like why those characteristics are related to this file, are not really informative to us.
It's a really diabolical problem when you're dealing with something like, you know, gaming code that's going to frequently look like malware, you know, and you've got a one size fits all model that's trying to classify all binaries on similar terms. You know, I mean, can you cheat so far as to say, well, software signed by this handful of gaming companies is going to have these types of characteristics and they should be considered less seriously than if they were in some, you know, unsigned binary from over there?
Yeah, life would be easier if, all vendors code signed. But beyond the lack of signatures, there are actually legit cases of benign polymorphism where you have game systems that will generate polymorphic executable files. So it's a real mess. Yeah.
So how do you address that? I mean, you mentioned that there are sort of tweaks, but you still have to play by the rules of the model. So how do you get exactly around that?
So at Silence, we really kind of like take a data science approach. And this is sort of something where we're sort of doing like, I guess I would compare it to like doing heart surgery on the model. Like, but we've, at least it was originally heart surgery, but we've really made just like taking it to an operational level where it's not quite heart surgery anymore. It's really like automated heart surgery. So we can kind of like figure out for some specific set of files what about those files are like really should be suspicious and which things are sort of like just sort of like incidental statistical anomalies. I should say also that a lot of how machine learning fits into the product is still driven by human analysts. So we have machine learning on the endpoint, we have machine learning in the cloud, we have all kinds of machine learning, you know, helping us everywhere and amplifying our analysts. But at the end of the day, there are humans who are really validating and then reinforcing the model and helping correct its interpretation of the features. So there's always constant feedback between the machine teaching the humans about what characteristics malware might have and what malware looks like and finding new cases of zero-day malware, perhaps even. But then also the humans are part of that feedback loop and help the model to sort of correct its possibly misinformed importance on some characteristics that it
might
pick up.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of human hours involved in running something like this, which is kind of interesting, right? Because it's just a more efficient way to do it than, you know, just going for signatures, for example, right? So instead of having people generating, you know, doing manual analysis and spitting out hashes, you know, in this case, you've got people actually trying to subtly improve the detection capability as a model, right?
Exactly. And so like naively, what one would do is really just have the humans apply like in machine learning, like labels of just like benign or malicious or maybe by like more finer classification.
And you would think that the model would just sort of tweak around that, right?
And it does, but then what we get is sort of like this confusion on the model's part of like which features are actually important and which features are sort of incidentally important because of the training data that you happen to have at the time that you trained the model. So the next step that we're really getting into at Silence is where humans can kind of like provide more input into the model than just like, here's a good label, here's a bad label, but also help guide the model to determine which features are most useful and which ones are least useful for sort of generalizing to the future and to new unseen executables.
I think there's a bit of an assumption out there in, you know, among users that technology like Silence, it is just like an auto magic algorithm, but it's just really, really not.
That's exactly right. It really is not. But it is like there is something magical about it. And I think that part of the difficulty of explanation is part of what makes it magic. But like it was interesting, Peter Norvig, who's a director of research at Google, was recently speaking and said that it was it's not really useful to kind of like force explanations out of a model, basically. And the comparison he gave was that, you know, if you ask a human like why they did something, they can't always answer you either. Like you can't always depend on a human to explain why they made a decision. So if a human can't do it, then maybe like a model can't either. So I'm maybe like paraphrasing what he said, but that was the gist of it, I think. The next step that he recommended was to just have a simpler, more interpretable model that is sort of a surrogate for the real model and kind of have like a model which is really capable of like maybe not having the same efficacy and being able to perform as well like in tests, but is sort of like more capable of telling the story to the humans about kind of like translating almost back and forth between like what the model is doing and helping a human to understand like.
But doesn't that run the risk of the two models sort of diverging at some point? And then you've got your sort of test basic watered down model telling you something that, you know, where the real model's just run off and it's over there now.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, and this is a case where I think in security, it maybe does make sense to have two models, two explainer models, or at least one explainer model that can be externally facing. One of the big concerns about really exposing the explanations of the sort of the the true gold standard model.
Well, is then really, people can start to enumerate it and slide stuff past the ML, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's really like the keys to the kingdom as far as like enumeration goes. Like it's really exactly what you would want. Because
so you want it to be transparent to you, but not to anybody else.
We want to be transparent to a point with customers and like other kind of like external agents. We don't want to deliberately keep them in the dark completely. But we definitely want to kind of like have layer between the sort of how all the intricacies of the model and then what we present to customers.
So really, when it comes down to explainability, it is about introducing that from your perspective as someone who is responsible for wrangling this machine learning algo. From your point of view, it's really about helping you to build a feedback loop that connects real world analysts, you know, to the model in a way where they can meaningfully manipulate that and understand what it's doing. I'm presuming, you know, just from the conversation we've had, that you've built some sort of explainability model. But was this something where at some point in Silence's history, you sort of had to go back and do some substantial re-engineering so that you could actually close that feedback loop?
I'm going to say no. I would say even if we couldn't, it's not that much of a problem because we mostly need to look forward. So the feedback loop is mostly about improving what we have today and making a better model tomorrow. So it's not really necessary to sort of like backport all of the old models, but there certainly are ways to do that. And actually, like the LIME method that I mentioned earlier is sort of like a really reasonable approach for that. You know, especially like with enumeration, like we want to avoid like enumeration, but the other thing is like well poisoning, and that's like something that I know like Ryan Perma, who gave an interview like I think a couple of months ago. He mentioned, and especially with a PE data set, it would be extremely difficult to poison the well. But, you know, we certainly do take measures to kind of guard against those attacks. And one of them is kind of related to the explainability in the sense that we want to be able to detect if there is poisoning going on. And one of the ways of doing that is by looking at what the model is picking up as malicious or not malicious from a characteristic perspective, and determining whether or not like those are sort of like valid, whether or not those line up at all with an expert opinion. And if an expert disagrees, then you know we can even have ways for sort of like the model can try to convince an expert like why this should be like this. So we can have a sort of potentially support even a dialogue between like a human and the machine learning about whether it makes sense for a particular characteristic to be treated as important.
Insert Terminator theme music here. Homer Strong, that's all fascinating stuff, mate. Thank you very much for joining us on the show to talk to us about some of these machine learning concepts. It's really interesting.
Oh, my pleasure, Pat. It's wonderful to talk with you.
That was the fabulously talented and all-round smart guy, Homer Strong, there. He is, of course, the director of data science at Silence, and you can check out Silence at CYLANCE.com. And yeah, if you're looking around for AV solutions and you're using legacy products from the likes of McAfee, Symantec, or Trend, honestly, do yourself a favor and take a look at what else is out there these days. There are newer vendors like Silence and a bunch of others making software that just works better and it is easier to run. So Silence should be in the eval mix if you're looking at that. And yeah, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.